Support for NPR podcasts comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday.
This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, a fascinating new report called Do Movies Make Money? Prescribe strong medicine the studios will have a tough time swallowing. Plus, the Westmores have been Hollywood's first family of makeup since there was a Hollywood. Will the next generation go into the family business? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. On the sixth day of Hanukkah, my true love gave to me The Business from NPR. In a stunning about-face, Hollywood's writers and studios started to talk to each other with something like respect, with both sides hinting that a framework for a deal might be in the offing. And then, kablooey! In a statement issued Friday evening after walking out of talks, the producers said that the WGA's, quote, quixotic pursuit of radical demands led them to begin this strike and has now caused this breakdown in negotiations. We hope that the WGA will come back to this table with a rational plan that can lead us to a fair and equitable resolution to a strike that is causing so much distress for so many people in our industry and community. In other words, you filthy writers will do what we want, when we want it, or you can go to hell. The strikes already caused many TV shows to go into reruns or to disappear completely, and many production deals to be 86'd. Now, it looks like the TV pilot season will be eviscerated. Be prepared for a spring full of reality TV and a new fall season full of more reality TV. Unreal. The singer-songwriter James You're Beautiful Blunt became the first artist to participate in the new service last week. He performed four old songs and debuted a new single. It's been reported that for this inaugural performance, MySpace did not share in the revenue. Elsewhere, not only are social networks getting deeper into the music business, so are makers of wireless phones. Last week, the world's number one manufacturer of cell phones and the world's largest recording company said they'd start giving away music for free. Well, sort of. Universal Music Group will offer unlimited free downloads of its songs onto certain Nokia media-enabled phones. You get the idea here. Nokia wants to hype their cell phones as iPod killers, and Universal, like every other record company, needs to find new revenue streams after nearly bleeding to death from piracy. Finally, some interesting news from across the pond for concertgoers. The managers behind top UK acts like Radiohead and Arctic Monkeys have called for a tax to be added to tickets resold on the internet. The UK managers, who also represent 400 other artists, have teamed up to create the Resale Rights Society. Under their plan, musicians would get a share in the proceeds of every ticket resold on websites like eBay. Of course, it'll be a little more difficult to tax that guy in the raincoat in front of Madison Square Garden saying, I'm buying tickets, I'm selling tickets. You got tickets? I gotta take two. You got four there? All right, I'll buy them for you. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, making a living in Hollywood ain't what it used to be. But next, do movies make money? Last month, the research firm Global Media Intelligence put out a provocative analysis of the studio's balance sheets with the even more provocative title, Do Movies Make Money? The answer is that while tons of money is being made in the movie business, it isn't necessarily going to the people who own the movies. Contrary to what you might think based on those bloated box office numbers you see in the papers, the studios actually lose bushels of cash on the first cycle of a movie's life. That is, in theaters, on DVD, video on demand, cable TV, free TV. They're all money losers. According to Global Media's analysis, studios are giving away a bigger and bigger share of what's called first-dollar gross to star actors, directors, and producers. They're using outside money to protect them against the downside, but that limits their upside. And let's not forget the runaway costs of making and marketing movies. Or so says Roger R. Smith, author of Do Movies Make Money? He's co-founder and executive editor of Global Media Intelligence. It's a media research service for major investors in media companies. Smith is no stranger to the business. He was an entertainment industry executive for 2 decades. Roger Smith, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much.
So your conclusion is that the movie-making business is a money-losing proposition. In fact, you say that from 2004 to 2006, the studios are going to lose $2 billion. During the current strike, the writer's strike that's going on right now, you've been kind of vilified for giving the studios fodder for their, hey, we're broke argument. Is somebody misunderstanding your conclusions?
Absolutely. And I was, frankly, as soon as this began, the process, and I said, oh, my God, that wasn't what I intended and certainly what isn't the import of what I'm saying. Lots of people make lots of money from the film business, but they are called stars, directors, producers, agents, talent managers, lawyers, publicists, etc. The people who own the films, News Corp, Time Warner, Viacom, NBC, Universal, they invested billions of dollars in the film business and are going to have losses to show for it over the coming years from their new production. The most important thing is that because they report overall profits, so people say, well, how can it be they're losing money? The profits come from the extraordinarily high profitability of the library titles. The bigger the library, Warner has the biggest, Fox isn't too far behind, Sony now controls portions of MGM's library. That's where the money is made, either because the pictures were made before residuals and participations were in, or more likely just they've been fully paid for, so-called amortized, and now they generate larger amounts of profit. How many businesses get to make a product in 1939 called Gone with the Wind that is, when it comes out in its special 50th anniversary and 60th anniversary DVD packages, is generating huge amounts of money for no additional investment beyond packaging and marketing?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a reason why people go into the film business and accept a much lower current return than most, if I may call them, normal businesses. The film business, I like to think of as a kind of manic depressive business, and 2 years out of three, the studios tell the world what a great business they have, and 1 year out of three, they cry poverty, and that just happens to be when all the guild contracts are due.
Cunning. So the writers want to make more money from new media, and the studios say, we're broke. What's the real story here?
Well, I've been in trouble so far with the writers and the actors, et cetera, for appearing to be a studio spokesman, which I am most definitely not. Global Media Intelligence is utterly independent. But the fact of the matter is that the writers, I think, have once again been suckered by the studios because they are being made to believe that it is the future which they must make demands on a contract that is going to last 3 years and get renegotiated again, the digital downloads, etc. It is the present. It is the huge pile of money from DVD where they have labored for years with an extremely unfavorable formula that the studios cleverly put in back in the 80s and told them that sacrosanct. We won't touch that formula. Well, that's where the money is.
Now, the big headline about your report came from the fact that you estimate profit participation, that is, you know, big stars who get first dollar gross and that sort of thing, has increased dramatically in the last few years, and that is cutting deeply into the studio's short and long-term profits. So we should ask you, first of all, why are stars getting these gigantic deals? And do you think that's money well spent? Because the consensus seems to be, you know, stars don't guarantee upside. They only protect against downside, and they're giving away the upside.
But, in fact, the protection against the downside is what the studio executives want. They simply do not want to be tagged with having given the green light to a massive loser. And with so much money involved in productions today of $150 million being almost commonplace, they want that. The stars are an insurance policy that the picture will open. If the picture is truly bad, it won't perform, but at least chances are you'll get most, if not all, of your money back.
Mm-hmm. Now, big producers like, you know, Brian Grazer and Ron Howard and Scott Rudin and Jerry Bruckheimer, these sort of household name guys, they often get what they call first dollar deals also. That's that they get paid before anybody gets paid, the studio or the movie theaters. Why is that? Especially since it seems like they take very little risk.
I would say the correct answer to that is I haven't a clue. And at the risk of being politically incorrect and damaging my future employment prospects, the payments to them are not simply excessive. They are absurd. They are paid very handsome housekeeping deals so they don't have to, for God's sakes, pay for a lunch check. And on top of this, they put up zero money, except maybe they option a property for a couple of $1 million, which is the studio's money, too.
Mm-hmm. So you're left scratching your head.
I'm left scratching my head, except if I want to be slightly conspiratorial, I would say, what does the average studio executive hope to become when he happily doesn't have to run a studio anymore? An independent producer. Now, he likes the terms of this trade if he's going to be on the receiving end in the future.
Now, you say in your report that studios like Fox and New Line are doing a bit better, or a lot better, actually, than the rest of the studios. Why is that?
Well, they are the, I call it the sort of the exception that proves the rule. It is not inherent in the movie business that you have to spend so much that you don't get it back. A Jim Carrey picture that they halted just weeks before it was to go into production because the budget rose to over $112 million and they decided it wasn't worth it with huge star participations.
And they'd already spent millions on sets, on scripts, and everything.
They had done that, but it was a moment of great wisdom when they decided to call halt to it as opposed to say, well, we're in for $5 million and I don't want to take a write-off.
I think that's called throwing good money after bad.
Yes, which is something the industry consistently does. And look, everyone listening to this, I hope, understands that deciding which pictures the public is going to like is not a simple business. Doing it on a consistent basis is extremely hard. But if you would add financial discipline to good judgment about material, you get Fox and New Line. New Line pursues the business in a way like the old-fashioned independents in that they keep domestic and they sell off the foreign and grossly reduce their risk. They probably have they're profitable every year, and last year was a year in which they didn't have a single hit, and they're going to make money. When I say last year, I mean this year.
Gotcha. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Roger Smith of Global Media Intelligence about his new report, Do Movies Make Money? He says the studios lost nearly $2 billion on their first-run movies last year. That's largely because they're giving away the upside in huge revenue deals with stars, directors, and producers. But I'm confused about one thing in your report. The MPAA says studios aren't spending more making movies, but clearly budgets are going up. So why the discrepancy?
Because the MPAA's publicly released data relates only to the amounts the studios themselves spent. And in the last 3 years, they have brought in $12 billion of outside financing from Wall Street, mostly from hedge funds, in the form of participation in production slates. Some of them, and you know, one of them is partnered with Fox, and they've done very, very well. The deals are not inherently bad, but they are based on terms that the studios were thrilled to make these deals because they gave up much less on the upside had the pictures worked than they protected themselves on the downside for those pictures that didn't work, which are, as always in this business, the majority.
So how has this outside Wall Street money changed the business?
Well, I think it contributed to their being a little more profligate than they would otherwise because they didn't have to go to their parent companies and ask for money. They didn't have to go to New York and say to the Time Warner people, we need money, or the same with Viacom. So that they were able to get it and say, oh, don't worry, we've got it financed, we've laid off some of the risk. It all looked very rational. But as you say, the people who put up the money are probably in the fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me category.
In your report, you say Hollywood must begin a serious attempt to rein in costs. And you add, I think, interestingly, something, and I'm quoting from you here, something well within the studio's power, end quote. So if that's true, why haven't they done it?
Because And this is something that's very good about the movie business. It's one of the last industries in America or even the world that is truly competitive. Six studios and a whole bunch of independents open 20, 30 pictures every Friday, and they're going hammer and tong at each other to make money. But there is a competition among a bunch of healthy people driven by huge egos and lots of money, as we know, to have the winner. The biggest problem is this, and I think it's best illustrated by a little bit of history. In 1987 or 8, I believe, Bob Daley was running Warner Brothers, and John Hughes, who had made Pretty in Pink and a lot of successful teen pictures, had come in with a project called Home Alone. It was originally budgeted at a now somewhat quaint-sounding $14 million. When John Hughes informed Mr. Daley, and I have this all on hearsay, but good hearsay, that it was going to cost $17 million. Bob drew a line in the sand and said, no, we'll bring it back from Chicago. We'll shoot it on the lot. We're not going to spend $3 million more. It's 14 or nothing. Mr. Hughes picked up the phone to Joe Roth, who was then head of production at Fox, and I'm told he got a yes in 20 minutes over the phone. Fox has probably pulled in $800 million of profit from Home Alone 1, 2, and 3, related merchandise, DVDs, etc. So everybody is so afraid that they're going to be the one who is laughed at because they were, you know, worried about a couple million dollars. But except now it's not a couple million, it's 30, 40, 50.
So what's your conclusion for the future of the business itself if things are getting so woolly?
Well, I'm going to now go out on a real limb and be optimistic. I think more smaller budgeted, better, more intelligent pictures will get made. They will be aimed at an older audience. They will not all be trying to get comic book heroes up on the screen for $250 million. And I think those of us who love movies, which with all this talk of money, I hate to say, I truly love the medium, and nothing thrills me as much as seeing a good picture, which is also a success. I think there's going to be a return to, I don't want to say the 70s because there's a lot of economic reasons why those were different. But as someone, I think as you point out, Claude, we now have, in addition to the DVD market, we have digital downloads, we have pay-per-view, now called video on demand, and then the old traditional pay television of HBO and Showtime, and then beyond that, free television. And most of these markets, the traditional markets are shrinking, the new markets are growing by huge percentages, but from such a small base that their growth doesn't offset the shrinking of the older markets.
So, I mean, do you think any of this is really news to the studios?
No, every studio knows their own books. I think that they should be pleased to learn that they're not the only ones who are having such serious profit problems. Again, I assume there's a degree of chortling over on Pico among the people at Fox that they're at their good fortune, and it's not just luck. Obviously, you can't consistently pick winning movies and control costs based on luck.
So if they know what they have to do, why haven't they done it?
Ego is the simplest reason. The antitrust rules are another reason. They can't. In the old days, they would have all managed Jack Warner and everybody would have gotten together somehow by accident in Palm Springs over the weekend and hashed it out. But they can't do that anymore, nor would they. So there is, I think, it is a business driven by the gross, and the net is always going to be secondary. It's just in the nature of it. It's in the fact that everybody in America picks up their newspaper or their clicks on the internet Sunday night or Monday morning and knows what every picture grossed that weekend.
Roger, we got to leave it there. Roger R. Smith is the co-founder and executive editor of Global Media Intelligence, a media research service for major investors in media companies. He was an entertainment industry executive from 74 to 96. He joined us from studios in New York. Roger, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you so much.
After a short break, how much longer can the Westmores of Hollywood afford to work in Hollywood? Stick around. It's The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. With rapacious superstar actors, directors, and producers entitled to a third of gross revenues before anyone else gets paid, it isn't just the studio's solvency that's at risk. It's the livelihood of thousands upon thousands of expert artisans and tradesmen that's in peril. You know, the folks whose names are still scrolling up the screen as you're walking out of the multiplex or falling asleep in front of the TV. Even a working-class dynasty that's been in Hollywood as long as there's been a Hollywood is not immune to the vagaries of life in the new business of show business. Our producer Darby Maloney has the story.
George Westmore started out as a hairdresser on the Isle of Wight. In 1909, he boarded a ship for the New World with his wife, four kids, and $35. He worked for years in hair salons across North America before finally landing in Hollywood in 1917. Back then, the movie business was far from the sophisticated industry we know today, and the silent films were more like vaudeville than the epic pictures of the Golden Age. Actors wore bulky wigs and did their own makeup, poorly. I spoke with Marvin Westmore, one of George's grandsons, a burly man in his 70s, at the Westmore Makeup Academy he founded in Burbank.
You know, you take a look at those old black and white films, those silent films, everything is very crude, very heavy-handed. They were like your Halloween wigs.
According to a memoir by his youngest son, Frank, George Westmore broke into the business when he talked the Selig Film Studio into paying him $25 a week to work on their famed jungle pictures. But grooming Jackie the Lion's mane grew old fast, so he leapt at the chance to make a wig for Billy Burke, who years later would glimmer as Glinda the Good Witch in The Wizard of Oz. By then, George's reputation as a wig master had gotten around, and everybody wanted one of his signature crocheted European-style hair lace wigs. But George Westmore didn't stop at hair. Marvin says that his grandfather also wanted to conquer makeup.
And who wore makeup in those days? Prostitutes. And so what he did is he traded hair services for makeup lessons. And that's how he learned how to do beauty makeup.
George Westmore hit the big time when he was hired to create the first hair and makeup department at Triangle Studios, home of the Keystone Cops and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. For the industry, this and the Selig Studio Department would help set the stage for the next phase of the business. And for George personally, this would begin his family's Hollywood dynasty that has lasted over 90 years and, pun intended, changed the face of Hollywood makeup to this day. When George got started, the movie industry was as wide open as the orange groves that dominated Los Angeles. And jobs were readily available for go-getters like George Westmore and his six sons. Grandson Marvin tells the story.
Adolph Manjou, who had a very thin, pencil-like mustache, he accidentally shaved it.
George wasn't available, so one of his sons stepped in.
Purse grabbed the opportunity, and on a piece of lace, ventilated a duplicate to the other side.
As Hollywood grew, so did the prominence of George Westmore's six sons, Purse, Earn, Monty, Wally, Bud, and later Frank. In the era of the studio system, each studio functioned like a factory with departments for every facet of filmmaking, from sets to wardrobe to writing. The Westmores ran the studio's hair and makeup departments, which meant that they were the bosses of a team of hairstylists and makeup artists who worked on every single picture that a given studio made, regardless of genre or style. It was a model that benefited the studio's bottom line and gave workers a steady income.
In those days, you went to work for a studio and you stayed there your lot for your life.
Michael Westmore is another of George's grandsons and a recently retired makeup artist.
You were part of the staff. Once you were accepted in there, you were a staff member and you were just moved from film to film to film.
During the heyday of the studio system, Hollywood functioned like any industry town. And as department heads, the Westmores were company power brokers. They controlled who got jobs and who entered the coveted studio apprenticeship programs, where everyone learned makeup in those days. This access made it easy for Marvin and his brothers to join the business. When they needed jobs, the reliable studio post was there. Grandson, Marvin.
I came out of this military service, married with one child, and working at a liquor store, and my older brother, my mother said, here's a makeup case, you're going to go work in the studios.
But the business was changing. When Marvin and his older brother, Monty Jr., went to work in the 1950s, the studio departments and apprenticeships still ran, but the studio system was all but dead. Plus, where there'd been a few master tradespeople, now there was an army of them. Whereas older Westmores had cobbled together prosthetics with grapefruit peel and made blood with caro syrup and relied on their ingenuity, now these techniques had been passed on, and new materials were widely available. So when the studio system finally disappeared, it was every production tradesperson and craftsman for himself.
Where in the old days, when you had a department, people were on salary. Now, there's no such thing as a makeup department in any studio anymore.
George's grandson, Michael Westmore, whose credits include Raging Bull, an Oscar for Mask, and a ton of Emmys, many for his 18 years on Star Trek, worked under the old system and the new.
There's a trailer parked outside, and depending on how big the actor is, depends on how big the trailer is, and there's a makeup setup in there, and they get made up. They go to the set. When the picture wraps, that trailer's sent back to the rental, and that makeup artist goes to another show.
Again, Marvin Westmore.
When the studio system died, the studios found out that for their financial benefit, they were better to rent their facilities to independent producers and directors to do their films than it was to try and maintain a whole, you know, a carpentry crew, an upholstery crew, a prop room, a wardrobe.
In this system, Hollywood tradespeople like the Westmores vie for jobs in an erratic freelance world where earning a steady paycheck is no guarantee. Before retiring, Marvin Westmore toiled in this world.
I've had as high as 14 employers in 1 year. And the average person, if they get an unemployed period, it's devastating. And that's just part of our lifestyle.
Kevin, Marvin's son and George's great-grandson, grew up on the sets with his dad and uncles, so he saw the old system. But when Kevin actually became a makeup artist in the 1980s, he was one of the first Westmores to never work in it.
Crazy business as it is, you're almost a carnival worker because you never know where your next job's coming from. So I'm calling everybody I know and going, hey, do you need me? You got to be a go-getter to stay up on the top to make a living at it.
Now Kevin, who's in his 50s, is no slouch. He won a couple of Emmys for his work on The X-Files. But in this current system, talent only takes you so far. And while being a Westmore may be a source of pride, it's not a source of work.
Yes, the name Westmore meant a lot. Today, it doesn't open any doors or close any doors, but it doesn't really do anything anymore.
Marvin and others in the family lament that the focus in today's Hollywood undermines the art of the business that their family held dear.
It's a giant multinational business, and all they think about is the bottom line. They don't think quality.
And with the people at the top in Hollywood making so much money these days, the tradespeople are often getting squeezed out of the middle class figuratively, and with high Los Angeles real estate prices, out of town, literally. So why do working people continue to flock to Hollywood? Glamour is a big reason. But for Kevin Westmore, it's almost genetic.
You have to love this business, and it seems like it's been an inherited love.
And for his dad, Marvin, it's complicated. On the one hand, he runs the Westmore Academy, training people to be makeup artists. And yet, he sees today that the risk for failure in this business is staggering.
I wouldn't wish this on anybody, because you've got to just really want to do it. And if you don't really want to do it, you'll be a failure. And no one wants their kids to be failures.
For The Business, this is Darby Maloney.
A postscript. Three generations of the Westmore family will be honored by a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame next year. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.